And Art is going to come up and introduce our speaker.
Thanks, Dave.
Hi, everybody. My name is Art Sutherland. I'm an alcoholic. I've had the privilege of sponsoring Gus for a month. That privilege came about by, you know, we say in the readings we're not saints. Your former sponsor is a saint tonight. Everybody knows Randy P., and Gus will talk about Randy P., and Randy influenced my sobriety tremendously. And so Gus has asked me to help him, and that's what an order. I can't go through with it. Following Randy, that's a tough deal. But Randy prepared him well. He ain't much trouble at all. It's a pretty cool deal, and I'm anxious to hear your story. Heard what guys have said about his service work. I'm telling you, Gus has a commitment to service, and we'll hear all about that. With that, I give you Gus.
I'm Gus. I am an alcoholic. I want to thank everybody for their kind words. And you guys are going to have to figure out how you're going to split a $100 bill for that introduction. You know, by the grace of God, this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, phenomenal sponsorship, service work. I haven't had a drink or any mind-altering substances since November 20th of 2012. And I'll be in debt to Alcoholics Anonymous for the rest of my life because it has given me more than I have ever dreamed. I'm a member also of the alumni group in Athens. We meet twice a week, Sundays and Wednesdays, and twice a month we'll have a big book study. And then the rest of the other Wednesdays we have open discussion. If you're ever in Athens, Georgia, more than welcome to come by and see us. And like Art had said, my previous sponsor, who was, I believe he's a saint, passed away May 6th of this year. Had been my sponsor for 13 and a half years. He guided me through the steps and showed me a phenomenal path. He introduced me to the Alana Men's Workshop, which is a vital part of my recovery. Introduced me to service work, as many people had said that I'm heavily involved in. But most importantly, he introduced me to God. And that was the first contract that Randy, when he finally agreed to sponsor me, and the first time he had told me no, then after being very persistent, what I'll disclose later on, when he finally said yes, and he told me like this. He said, my responsibility is to introduce you to God, and it's your responsibility to have a conversation with him. And I have conversations with God on a daily basis, sometimes even on a moment-to-moment basis. Prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, very young age, there was alcoholic tendencies. And you hear this a lot with other speakers and stuff, and you know, they say they had the isms. I grew up in an alcoholic household, so I believe the isms were there. But the day I discovered alcohol, I finally experienced relief. And of course, like a good alcoholic, the first time I drank, I got drunk, and it was a bad one. I mean, I drank for annihilation. But something happened when I took that first drink. You know, I can still remember it to this day. I was 13 years old. We were in an alleyway with a bunch of friends, and we called ourselves the Alcoholics. We had never really drank before, but come to find out I was the real alcoholic. They drank, but they didn't drink how I drank. But I remember when I took that first shot of this concoction we had mixed all together, that ease and comfort. And it talks about that in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, in the doctor's opinion. And I remember taking that shot, and as that shot went down my throat and it reached my gut, I felt that relief. And it was one of those feelings that as soon as I took that shot, I was able to go, there it is, finally. And I chased that feeling for 20 semi-years. The progression caught up with me pretty quick, that by the time I was 18 years old, I was pretty much full-blown alcoholic. But I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous because my dad had gotten sober. And I remember as a kid, we were going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings when he was first trying to get it. You know, I remember going to church basements and, you know, all these weird-looking people like they are here now. You know? And everybody's drinking coffee and having a good time, and I didn't know anything about it. Later on in life, I realized that, oh, yeah, I came into AA at a very, very young age, still in diapers, pretty much. I started experiencing some consequences at a very early age. The first time I got arrested, I was like 17 years old. I used to live in New York City, and the first time I went to jail, I went to Rikers Island. That's terrible. Makes DeKalb County look like the Marriott. And you think that that would be enough, but it wasn't. You know, I had that, you know, mentality of they were out to get me. And that's how I felt my entire life. They're out to get me. People are out there to screw me over. And I never looked at my part as a kid. It was always because I was involved in self. I can see that today. I was very involved and consumed by self. You know, as I continued to live life as best as I could, I would have little brief moments of abstinence. But I remember when I wouldn't drink, I was restless, irritable, and discontented. Tell you, I was not a person that you would want to cross paths with because I would fly off the handle. But if I get a shot of liquor in me, I was the nicest person in the world until I overshot the mark, and then I wanted to fight everybody in the bar. And I grew up in an Irish-Italian neighborhood, a place called Sunnyside, Queens in New York. And I drank with a lot of the Irish guys. We all worked together and stuff. And, you know, one of the early consequences besides going to Rikers Island was I was starting to get banned from all these pubs. You know, and that's pretty bad when you start getting kicked out of Irish pubs. When they're like, we're not serving you. That was one of the last times one of the bartenders told me. He was like, I'm not serving you. You know, as I was putting a bottle of, Guinness through the mirrors in the background and busted that all out. And it was about 20 to 30 bars, pubs in that stretch of my neighborhood, and I was banned from every single one of those. So I just quit drinking at pubs. I drank at home. And it's kind of insane, but as I got older, I thought it was a good idea to go cash my check at the liquor store. No, I don't recommend it at all, because what happens is once you get that money and they cash your check, then you start to look on the displays and you're like, give me a bottle of that. That's how I live my life. Constantly the same thing. Go to work, drink, and rinse and repeat. But I remember the first time things got out of when they got out of control, I wound up going to a detox center. And this was at a hospital in Flushing, Queens, and I remember coming to. But I don't remember how I got there. I just remember waking up and I was already dressed out in the little gowns and the little foam slippers with the happy face. As I was doing the Thorazine shuffle up and down the, you know, aisle, eating everything inside because I hadn't eaten a decent meal in weeks. I remember talking to some counselors and some nurses, and next thing I know, I was free to go. But the insane part, after being there for 7 days, that as soon as my feet landed in my neighborhood, the first thing I did was buy a six-pack of beer. And off I went again. And then this time I wound up at a treatment center. You know, and then this is kind of crazy because I think the government did away with TCs, which was therapeutic communities. They were real popular in the 60s. But I think somewhere in the 90s they said, yeah, we need to get rid of these. These are a little out of control. Because those were the kind of places where they would put you under contract and, you know, they would shave your head, you know, if you didn't act right, and they would dress you up, and I stayed in trouble all the time. So I would wear this giant oak tag, you know, and under contract, they call it, you know, and they would have some writings that had me stand on the corner. They would have me sweep the sun off the roof and sweep the moon off the roof, and GI parties on our hands and knees, scrubbing the floors with water, and crazy. I didn't get nothing out of it. Actually, I was close to graduation, and I got into it with a counselor, which is a huge part of a miracle that happened during the ninth step. Me and him got into a physical altercation. I broke my hand on his jaw. He got fired. They kept me there for a few days, and then they discharged me. I went across the street, casting all, drinking a 40-ounce, and I put it through the rehab window. I don't know what it is. I like throwing things when I get drunk. I don't know. As I went back to the neighborhood and I continued on drinking with a bunch of friends, and you know, and then I wound up at another place. And my relapses and consequences go pretty quick as I gotten older. And so I wound up at another place called St. Christopher's Inn in upstate New York, This was the place that Jackie Gleason used to go dry out at. Matter of fact, they had his all pool table. I thought it was pretty cool. Very spiritual place. It was run by Franciscan Friars of Atonement. A lot of Catholic priests that were members of our fellowship lived there, including, I think, Father Martin had passed through there one time, and a few other AA members or circuit speakers. And so I stayed there the entire length. They had a treatment side and they had a homeless shelter side. I remember sitting down with one priest and he explained to me the program, which nobody had really ever explained it to me. I knew about AA, but all I knew was this is where people come to stop drinking. I didn't know about the steps. I didn't know about the big book. I had no clue what goes on here. But he explained to me and I said, "Well, I think I need that." And that was my first moment of identification. Because before, even in treatment and in the detox centers, you know, there was always a part of me that said, "I'm not like them." Because my vision of the alcoholic, or my picture of the alcoholic, was the guy that slept under the bridge with the brown sack, you know, with the cardboard sign holding it up in the road. That's the alcoholic. I wasn't the alcoholic. Later on, I found out that wasn't true. That's called a bum. But I was that one. I was one of those guys too. I was a bum. I remember when I graduated and I finally went back home and I had a couple of suitcases and I got back, you know, by train. And I remember looking down in my neighborhood from the platform at the train station, and I seen all the neon signs, you know, pub, bar, pub, pub, bar, liquor store, pub. I was scared for the first time. I was like, I don't think I can walk down that street. I had respect for alcohol because it had burned me a couple of times. You know, I said, I don't want to do that. But I did something that, you know, that perhaps it was the grace of God, but I decided to go to an AA meeting for the first time on my own. And I got to this group. It was called Kim Miller Folter in Woodside, Queens, and it meant 1,000 welcomes in Gaelic. And I was pretty impressed because I've never seen an Irish man sober. Didn't even know they existed. And it's astonishing that they have AA meetings in Ireland, because, you know, the way we drank, you know, and the guys I drank with, I was like, they're going to die drunk. Matter of fact, during the World Cup, the Scottish came up to Boston and drank the whole city dry one weekend. The Irish can do it too, easily. So when I got there was a couple of friends that I knew from the neighborhood, and they had joined the fellowship and they were doing well. But one of the biggest miracles was, you know, the guy that I had labeled the alcoholic with the brown sack. There was a guy that used to be in my neighborhood like that, and he didn't look like that anymore. He was sober, clean cut. Matter of fact, he read the preamble in Gaelic, which was pretty impressive to me. You know, and as I went around with some of these guys and kind of checked out of different meetings in the neighborhood, I had seen this one guy who was, you know, from Ireland, and his English wasn't all that great. And one night in a church basement meeting, I asked him to be my sponsor. And he asked me with his very thick brogue, "Are you willing to go to any lengths for victory over alcohol?" Didn't know exactly what that meant, but I knew I needed something and I wanted what he had, and I said yes. The very next day, I called him, and it was a test, a willingness test, and I do this with all my guys too. I called him up exactly the time he told me to call him up. He gave me 1 hour's notice to be at a big book study. When I got there, he had me, you know, making coffee and setting up the chairs, and he wanted to see how willing I was, because he wasn't the type of person that would waste his time on somebody that was not willing. But I seemed pretty willing. A really good big book study, I remember that. I was quite nervous, but he took me through the steps the first time. I remember when I did my fifth step for the first time, I was like, finally, like, some real relief, you know. And then the ego returned. And it's so crazy with the alcoholic mind, the things we do, because I learned very quickly does the ego regenerate itself. See, the program, every single step is ego deflation. But left with untreated alcoholism, that judgment comes back. And that's the very first thing that happens. I get my judgment. Then I get my opinions. Then I start separating myself from the herd. Don't take long. And I remember I had picked up a chip, and I felt the urge to celebrate. The insanity of it all. This time it's not going to burn me. I'm gonna go across the street to this pub called Donovan's. I'm going to eat a cheeseburger, and I'm going to drink me a Guinness. Not a good idea. Well, another white chip. And we started over again because he felt the need that I had left something out of my porch set. So, long and behold, fast forward a little bit, we revisited the steps again, and I moved here in 2005. Actually, I came to Athens, and I moved to Atlanta. Went to this halfway house down the road here called Sober Living America. You know, I'm a graduate of there, and that was a rough one. I've been to some programs where it was like the step down of Betty Ford. This is nowhere near it. You know, you wake up in the middle of the night, you turn the lights on, and all the roaches and bed bugs are scattering all over the place. You don't know who to get first. You're going to go for the bed bugs, or you're going for the roaches. But that's what I went through. I wasn't mandated there, but I had a feeling that's what I needed. Because those nice, cushy places, just, it was more like a vacation for me. One place that I had been to up there in upstate New York, all that was missing was horseback riding. Everything else, I mean, the food was incredible. Made you want to keep coming back. They had an indoor and outdoor pool volleyball court, not SLA. Now, we barely had a van that would get us to and from meetings. If you were lucky, if you missed the van, you had to walk. And that's not to talk bad about the place. It was rough conditions, but for a lot of people, we need that. Yeah, and the other good part about it was that they didn't accept any money when I came in. Because I didn't have two nickels to rub together. And I know a lot of places, including where we're at, they charge an astronomical fee to get in. Drug addicts and alcoholics. And if we had money, we wouldn't be seeking treatment. We'd be looking for one more. But for the grace of God, I was exactly where I was supposed to be. And I did all right for a little while, and I asked Tim to be my sponsor. I used to come to meetings here in Napa, and, life was great, and, I wish I would have took this suggestion Randy Parsons gave me years ago and told me not to marry this crazy woman, and I did, and then, everything went to hell in a handbasket, and, that contributed to burning my life down to the ground and a little quick trip to Memorial Drive, and so I got to check out the Cab County Jail, and a miracle happened there. For years and years and years, as I was seeking change, and I'll tell you this, because I always walked around with my head down. I'm lucky I'm not hunchback, but tell people I'm seeking for change, looking for change. Yeah, loose change, right? But really, in all reality, I was looking for change in my life. I was just doing a low-bottom search for a higher power all those years. But when sitting at that DeKalb County Jail, and I did something I had never done before, which was a crucial part of my recovery. For the first time in my entire life, I finally surrendered to God. And I mean a real surrender. It's not like, oh God, if you get me out of this situation, I'll do whatever you ask me to do. Or if you can just get me a good lawyer, or if you get me this, really good job that's going to pay all my bills and get me out of this situation. I got on my knees on that jail cell, and I asked God to have all of me. When I was sitting there in that 23-hour lockdown facility, I was incarcerated with my own thoughts. I didn't have a roommate, so there was a lot of thinking going on. I got to evaluate my entire life and look at where I had gone wrong. And as I was sitting there for weeks, not knowing if I was going to go home or not, somebody that was kind enough in this room that I later on, at that time I didn't know who had done it. But this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous soft cover shows up. And they called my name, and this officer handed me this book. And I said, wow, I wonder who gave me this book. Who knows, I'm in jail. Well, I had talked to this one guy who was in drug court, and I said, well, if you ever go to an AA meeting, make sure you seek out this guy named Tim. He's over at Napa. But most of the time you ask people favors in jail, they'd say, yeah, I'll do it, and they never do. They're like, hell with that guy. You know, he's asking too much. But he actually followed through. But I didn't know who I'd send that book. And as soon as I got that book, I sat down in my bunk and I started reading it and highlighting and underlining. Oh, I even wrote a resentment list. And I had to, because I didn't want to go out there and back to society and continue to do the same thing I was doing, because I was tired. I kind of welcomed the idea that I was in there. I look at it now and I think God had put me on pause. I needed that. I needed a reset. Now, as I went through that book again, and I highlighted a bunch of stuff that I had, you know, the big book always, something new always pops up. That was when I was reading the doctor's opinion and reading Bill's story and more, you know, more about alcoholism. I remember looking back at my life and then saying, you know, in chapter 3 where it says, most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. You know, I said, you know, for years I was unwilling to admit, because it was a devastating blow to my ego. And there's a lot of other things in that chapter, which I'm going to read a little bit of. To me, it was crucial to really look at that in black and white so I can identify. And that was the thing that I needed, identification. And page 30, chapter 3, more about alcoholism. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove that we can drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of the disillusion is astonishing. Many pursue it to the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we had to fully conceive in our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people or presently has to be smashed. And there was no lurking reservation of any kind. You know, looking at that first step, and I said, you know, I can admit I'm powerless over alcohol. Back then when I was younger, I couldn't see the unmanageability, because from the outside it looked like it was all together, but it wasn't. Because we're very delusional people. And I lived in a delusion for a long time. But when I finally admitted that powerlessness, that unmanageability, I was able to take step one. Then the second step, I started having an idea that these people in these Alcoholics Anonymous, they're trying to get me to believe in something that I don't want to really have anything to do with. Because me and God we didn't see eye to eye for a long time. And I had my reasons when I was younger, when I was a kid. But, you know, the good sponsor I had at the time told me, it's just a higher power. It doesn't matter what it is. It doesn't have to be that fire and brimstone higher power that you heard in Catholic school and Catholicism. Just anything. I just started praying to whatever. But I knew I had to turn my will and my life over to the care of this being, not knowing who it was. Then making that third step decision was crucial. To me it was, because the big book tells us there's no middle of the road solution. Either I'm going to continue to do this, or I'm going to continue to do what I was doing and continue to get what I was getting. But there is no middle of the road solution. And it was a clear cut declaration. Either God is everything, He is nothing. He either is or He isn't. What is our choice to be? And it was pretty clear the choice I had to make. Once I made that choice, I had to jump into vigorous action. And that was crucial, because I had to revisit all these people that had wronged me. So I thought, all these people, I'm making a list of all these people who had got over on me. But the reality of it is that I got over on them. I learned that later on in that fourth column. I didn't realize how resentful I was. Pretty much everybody I came in contact, I always found something about them that I didn't like. And that was another way of my ego separating me from the herd, separating me from God, and separating me from the entire planet. But looking at all the fears, the sex conduct, and everything else that the fourth step has to offer, I got to see my liabilities. Because for years I didn't know what made me tick. why did I keep doing the same thing over and over and getting the same result? What is it? What's going on here? But when I seen that I was selfish and self-centered, and the whole world revolved around me, and you knew that would be the first thing when I woke up in the morning, it was like, it's all about me. And that was the problem. I was so wrapped up in me that I couldn't get involved with any of you guys. And I was so wrapped up in myself that I had no time for God. And that was the problem. The doctor's opinion says the main problem for the alcoholic center is in the mind rather than the body, and that's absolutely true. Because my mind would tell me things that were not true. Fabricate these situations and scenarios. And like I said before, we're very delusional people. But we're sitting down with a good sponsor, him laying out the facts, was crucial because I got to see my part. The part that I had not wanted to see for a long time because, for all these years I was just an innocent bystander. But it wasn't the truth. I played a part in every single one of those resentments. And when I finally sat down, and I remember sitting in Randy Parsons' kitchen doing a fifth step. I mean, we went through a lot of pages and names, and, I would number every single one of those, and I got to experience real freedom doing that fifth step. Freedom, that feeling that I've chased with liquor for so many years. But the liquor quit working. This freedom was like nothing I've ever experienced before. I don't want to put a label on it, but if I were to say something, it was like a spiritual experience. But more work had to be done, of course. Now knowing all these liabilities, having them down on paper, looking at number 6 and 7, and I asked God to remove every single defect of character that stands in my way of being useful to Him. I have to replace Him with something else. See, when I was living that selfish and self-centered life, I had to become God-centered. When I become God-centered, I can think about you and what I can help you out with. That's what fuels my recovery. It's not meetings. I was told meeting makers make it, but that's about it. It's about the action. This is a program of action. It's cool to sit here for an hour and drink coffee and eat cookies. Not going to really get much. When you get involved in this program, and you'll experience something you've never experienced before. But once I had made that list, and I had another list of all those people that came out of my porch, Steph, and I had put them in a list of, people that I had harmed. And step 8, I had a look at these, and I was like, wow, that's a long list. I owed a lot of people money, I owed a lot of amends, and I did a lot of crazy stuff. But I was willing, because I wanted to continue experiencing that freedom. So I continued doing the work, and me and Randy Ann sat down, and we looked at all these names, and we put them into columns, and said, there's 3 parts of this step, so it was the direct amends, the wherever possible, and the ones that would injure them or other. I made a list of all these people that I owed money to, and I said, all right, these are all financial people. Get to it. Matter of fact, there was a guy that I had owed money to. Borrowed some money. It was like maybe 5 years or maybe 6 years prior to me getting sober. And I was like, I don't remember exactly what I owe him, but he's on that list. So that morning I got up and was going to work. And something told me to grab a $50 bill. Now, I normally don't carry cash, but I had some cash. And I said, all right, I'm going to take this $50 bill with me. So we got to Lowe's, and I recognized his red pickup truck. And I said, that's the guy. I recognized that pickup truck anywhere. Started walking around Lowe's looking for this guy, and he was sitting at the contractor desk. And I said, hey, man, how's it going? And I said, hey, a few years ago I borrowed some money from you, and I never returned it. I don't remember how much it was, but I want to pay you back. He said, $50. I was like, damn, that's crazy. I went out and made all these financial amends and was able to take care of every single one of those, including the IRS. That's a big one. So I continued on my journey, and everywhere I had gone, I had pretty much ran people off, or, I ran through their lives like a tornado, and there was a couple of countries that I had to call people from, and a couple of states, a couple of cities, and finally, when I got through the entire list, and I said, all right, what else are we going to do? And you say, well, we got to go through step 10. And that, to me, that's a huge step. Because, you know, after going off through all those amends, you get this false sense of achievement. And I think it's no coincidence the big book tells us, gives us a warning. It gives us the promises, and then it gives us a warning. Because it is easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. More action. You know, and I kept on and looking at my side of the street again, where I'd been selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate, or afraid. You know, who am I hurt? Was I love and kind to all? Not to some, but have I been kind and loving to all today? Very important. Now, like I said, I constantly talk to God. You know, I pray, I meditate. I talk to my new sponsor, Art. Crucial for me to continue to keep my side of the street clean. Because it doesn't take much for an alcoholic of my kind to accumulate debris that starts blocking myself off from God. And it's a matter of time before I start acting crazy. And then from there, I get drunk. I've proven that experiment over and over and over. But the highlight of my life today is on step 12. To continue to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Sponsor men. I got sponsees and Gulf Shores, Alabama, and I got another one in Athens, and you know, that's the highlight of my life, watching these guys get their lives back together. Because I can tell you from my own experience, this is not a selfish program. And I've heard it said in the rooms before, but it's not. My experience has showed me this is the most unselfless program. Because I know when I was able to have an experience with this, you know, I need to share this with somebody else immediately. That's been what's been working for me for so many years, almost 13 and a half years. For an alcoholic of my kind, the left of my own devices, I will tear everything down to the ground. But I know in my heart that if I help his children, God's children, through the process of Alcoholics Anonymous, I will have immunity over any situation that comes over in my life. Because it's always been told, you know, this too shall pass. But I think it's going to be, you know, I think it's a disaster at the moment. You know, and from a moment-to-moment basis, how I live my life, no matter what comes at me, it might look like total chaos. As long as I trust God, clean house, and help other people, it's going to be okay. It always is. And it's not the end of the world. And I'll share with you something else. May 6th, well, actually it was May 5th. Got to sit down with Randy Parsons' bedside. He told me three things while you were still conscious. He said, Gus, come here. I want to hug your neck. And I hugged him. And he said, carry the message. Help others. And look out after my daughter. And I said, I will. His final request before he passed. I'll never forget that. Even on his dying moments, when he knew the time was coming up, when his number was being called, he was still carrying the message. That's impressive. A lot of people would say, you know, the hell with AA, I'm going to die, who cares, give me a drink. But he didn't. From the moment he knew that his time was limited, there were so many people coming to his house and they were visiting him and he was talking to them. But that's a request that I want to share with you guys. Those that had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, carry the message. Help other alcoholics, because your life depends on it. And if you are new here in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, stay. It is the smartest thing you'll ever do. I always hear this thing, you know, my best thinking got me here. And I'll be honest with you, yeah, my best thinking did get me here. Thank God. Because if it would have been something different, I probably would have been dead. But to me, this is home, and I choose to stay, no matter what happens. Life happens sometimes, but there is always, if you don't take a drink of alcohol, you always have a standing chance. If you're new, I also recommend if you don't have a sponsor, get one. Start working the steps immediately, because there is life-changing stuff here. It really is. And I said before I was looking for change. That change turned into transformation. Drinking before, I was experiencing relief. But now, with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've experienced freedom. Thanks for letting me share.
All right. Thank you, Gus. I've been a witness. I heard what I needed to hear tonight.
First I slipped, and then I crept to a hope-filled dream. You rescued me, and finally, waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, God wants us, we walk eternally. Take me where the promises are.